content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, In Defense of Humanity by Adrian LaFrance. And this is a long article that will be edited to meet time constraints. On July 13, 1833, during a visit to the Cabinet of Natural History at the Jardin des Plantes in Paris, Ralph Waldo Emerson had an epiphany. Peering at the museum specimens, butterflies, hunks of amber and marble, carved seashells, he felt overwhelmed by the interconnectedness of nature and humankind's place within it. The experience inspired him to write The Uses of Natural History and to articulate a philosophy that put naturalism at the center of intellectual life in a technologically chaotic age, guiding him along with the collective of writers and radical thinkers known as transcendentalists to a new spiritual belief system. Through empirical observation of the natural world, Emerson believed anyone could become, quote, a definer and map maker of the latitudes and longitudes of our condition, end quote, finding agency, individuality, and wonder in a mechanized age. America was crackling with invention in those years, and everything seemed to be speeding up as a result. Factories and sugar mills popped up like dandelions. Steamships raced to and from American ports. Locomotives tore across the land. The telegraph connected people as never before. And the first photograph was taken, forever altering humanity's view of itself. The national mood was a mix of exuberance, anxiety, and dread. The flash of vision Emerson experienced in Paris was not a rejection of change, but a way of reimagining human potential as the world seemed to spin off its axis. Emerson's reaction to the technological renaissance of the 19th century is worth revisiting as we contemplate the great technological revolution of our own century, the rise of artificial superintelligence. Even before its recent leaps, artificial intelligence has for years roiled the informational seas in which we swim. Early disturbances arose from the ranking algorithms that have come to define the modern web, that is, the opaque code that tells Google which results to show you and that organizes and personalizes your feeds on social platforms like Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok by slurping up data about you as a way to assess what to spit back out. Now imagine this same internet infrastructure, but with programs that communicate with a veneer of authority on any subject, with the ability to generate sophisticated, original text, audio, and video, and the power to mimic individuals in a manner so convincing that people will not know what is real. These self-reaching AI models are being designed to become better at what they do with every single interaction, but they also sometimes hallucinate and manipulate and fabricate. And you cannot predict what they'll do or why they'll do it. If Google's search engine is the modern-day Library of Alexandria, the new AI will be a mercurial prophet. The technocultural norms and habits that have seized us during the triple revolution of the internet, smartphones, and the social web are themselves in need of a thorough correction. Too many people have allowed these technologies to simply wash over them. We would be wise to rectify the errors of the recent past, but also to anticipate and proactively shape what the far more radical technology now emerging will mean for our lives and how it will come to remake our civilization. What's coming stands to dwarf every technological creation in living memory, the internet, the personal computer, the atom bomb. It may well be the most consequential technology in all of human history. People are notoriously terrible at predicting the future and often slow to recognize a revolution, even when it is already underway. But the span of time between when new technology emerges and when standards and norms are hardened is often short. The Wild West, in other words, only lasts for so long. Eventually, the railroads standardize time. incandescent bulbs beat out arc lamps. The dream of open web dies. The window for effecting change in the realm of AI is still open. Yet many of those who have worked longest to establish guardrails for this new technology are despairing that the window is nearly closed. Generative AI, just like search engines, telephones, and locomotives before it, will allow us to do things with levels of proficiency so profound it will seem like magic. We may see whole categories of labor, and in some cases entire industries, wiped away with startling speed. The utopians among us will view this revolution as an opportunity to outsource busy work to machines for the higher purpose of human self-actualization. This new magic could indeed create more time to be spent on matters more deserving of our attention, deeper quests for knowledge, faster routes to scientific discovery, extra time for leisure with loved ones. It may also lead to widespread unemployment and the loss of professional confidence as a more competent AI looks over our shoulder. Governmental officials, along with other well-intentioned leaders, are groping towards ethical principles for artificial intelligence. See, for example, the White House's Blueprint for an AI Bill of Rights. These efforts are necessary, but not enough to meet the moment. We should know by now that neither the government's understanding of new technologies nor self-regulation by tech behemoths can adequately keep pace with the speed of technological change or Silicon Valley's capacity to seek profit and scale at the expense of societal and democratic health. What defines this next phase of human history must begin with the individual. Just as the Industrial Revolution sparked transcendentalism in the U.S. and Romanticism in Europe, both movements that challenged conformity and prioritized truth, nature, and individualism, today we need a cultural and philosophical revolution of our own. This new movement should prioritize humans above machines and reimagine human relationships with nature and with technology while still advancing what this technology can do at its best. Transparency should be a core tenet in the new human exchange of ideas. People ought to disclose whenever an artificial intelligence is present or has been used in communication. This ground rule could prompt discipline in creating more human and human-only spaces, as well as a less anonymous web. Any journalist can tell you that anonymity should be used only as a last resort and in rare scenarios for the public good. We would benefit from cultural norms that expect people to assert not just their opinions, but their actual names, too. Now is the time, as well, to recommit to making deeper connections with other people. Live video chat can collapse time and distance, but such technologies are a poor substitute for face-to-face communication, especially in settings where creative collaboration or learning is paramount. The pandemic made this painfully clear. Relationships cannot and should not be sustained in the digital realm alone, especially as AI further erodes our understanding of what is real. Tapping a like button is not friendship, it's a data point. And a conversation with an artificial intelligence is one-sided, an illusion of connection. Writers of fiction, Fyodor Dostoevsky, Rod Sterling, Jose Saramago, have for generations warned of doppelgangers that might sap our humanity by stealing a person's likeness. Our new world is a wormhole to that uncanny valley. Today's elementary school children are already learning not to trust that anything they see or hear through a screen is real, but they deserve a modern technological and informational environment built on enlightenment values, reason, human autonomy, and the respectful exchange of ideas. Not everything should be recorded or shared. There is individual freedom in embracing ephemerality. More human interactions should take place only between the people involved. Privacy is a key to preserving our humanity. We should trust human ingenuity and creative intuition and resist over-reliance on tools that dull the wisdom of our own aesthetics and intellect. Emerson once wrote that Isaac Newton used the same wit to weigh the moon that he used to buckle his shoes. Newton, I'll point out, also used that wit to invent a reflecting telescope. the beginnings of a powerful technology that has allowed humankind to squint at the origins of the universe. But in the spirit of Emerson's ideal remains crucial. Observing the world, taking it in using our senses, is an essential exercise on the path to knowledge. We can and should layer on technological tools that will aid us in this endeavor, but never at the expense of seeing, feeling, and ultimately knowing ourselves. The passage of time has the capacity to erase human knowledge. Whole languages disappear. Explorers lose their feel for crossing the oceans by gazing at the stars. Technology continually reshapes our intellectual capacities. What remains is the fact that we are on this planet to seek knowledge, truth, and beauty, and that we only get so much time to do it. As a small child in Concord, Massachusetts, I could see Emerson's home from my bedroom window. Recently, I went back for a visit. Emerson's house has always captured my imagination. He lived there for 47 years until his death in 1882. Today, it is maintained by his descendants and a small staff dedicated to his legacy. The house is some 200 years old and shows its age in creaks and stains, but it also possesses a quality that is extraordinarily rare for a structure of such a historic importance. 141 years after his death, Emerson's house still feels like it's his. His books are on the shelves. One of his hats hangs on a hook by the door. The original William Morris wallpaper is bright green in the carriage entryway. A rendering of Francesco Salvietti's The Three Fates, holding the thread of destiny, stands watch over the mantel in his study. This is the room in which Emerson wrote Nature. The table where he sat to write it is still there, next to the fireplace. Standing in Emerson's study, I thought about how no technology is as good as going to the place, whatever the destination. No book, no photograph, no television broadcast, no tweet, no meme, no augmented reality, no hologram, no AI-generated blueprint or fever dream can replace what we as humans experience. This is why you make the trip, you cross the ocean, you watch the sunset, you hear the crickets, you notice the phase of the moon. It is why you touch the arm of a person beside you as you laugh, and it is why you stand in awe at the Jardin des Plantes, floored by the universe as it reveals its hidden code to you. Our second article, Local Government Has Too Much Power, and That's Why Nothing Can Get Built, by Jerusalem Demsis. This is also an edited article. On a Wednesday afternoon in March, the Montview Boulevard Presbyterian Church in Denver's South Park Hill neighborhood was packed. The local chapter of the progressive group Indivisible was sponsoring a mayoral candidate forum. Five candidates had been invited to attend. The moderator asked the usual questions about crime and public safety, homelessness, and guns. Then came a question comprehensible only to a close observer of Denver politics. Do you support releasing the city-owned conservation easement on the Park Hill Golf Course to allow the currently proposed redevelopment of this site? Four candidates raised their hands, a couple only halfway, as if that sign of reluctance might lessen the coming disapproval. It didn't. The crowd booed. In 1997, Denver paid the owners of the Park Hill Golf Course $2 million to place a conservation easement on the property, limiting how it could be used. More than 20 years later, Westside Investment Partners bought the by-then-defunct golf course for $24 million. After a contentious community input process, lawsuits and allegations of stolen lawn signs, the company settled on a proposal to build 2,500 homes, including a significant number of affordable family and senior units, as well as some commercial space. It also promised to reserve two-thirds of the 155-acre property as open space. In 2021, Denver voters approved a ballot measure, giving themselves the power to decide the easement's fate. On April 4th of this year, voters declined to lift the easement. deciding what the people believe is not so easy. Colorado is short an estimated 127,000 homes. The Denver metro area alone is short nearly 70,000 homes. The housing shortage is the main driver of the region's affordability crisis, and housing policy experts, though they remain divided on many questions, are nearly unanimous in their belief that resolving it will require bringing many more homes to market. From 2012 to 2017, the region permitted only one new home for every 5.4 new jobs. Over the same period, home prices in Denver jumped by 50%. Voting for a candidate who champions pro-housing policies is one thing. Agreeing to new development in your neighborhood is another. Conflicting desires do not by themselves prove hypocrisy, however. Some people really do want to see more housing in general, even if they don't want construction next door. The problem is that the local institutions charged with land use decisions are attuned to parochial complaints, not large-scale needs. The level of government at which we choose to resolve a conflict shapes public opinion and eventual outcome. The same question posed at a town hall, at a county council meeting, in the governor's office, or by Congress will not be answered the same way in each venue. The tools available, the norms of debate, and the architecture of accountability change drastically from place to place. Americans believe that housing is a local issue, and it is a local issue, but it is also a regional issue, a state issue, and a national issue. By restricting the debate to the hyper-local level, we've blocked out our big-picture values. Across metro areas in states led by Democrats and Republicans alike, the same pattern emerges. Local governments decide what gets built and where, and they use that power to ban multifamily housing, entrench economic segregation, and perpetuate a national affordability crisis. In Denver, I spoke with dozens of community leaders, elected officials, and voters who live near the Park Hill Golf Course. Opponents of the project raise concerns about preserving open spaces, about gentrification, about the democratic process itself. Former Mayor Wellington Webb told me he opposes developing the Park Hill site because it's, quote, the last piece of open space land in Denver, end quote. Leslie Herod, a Colorado state representative and an unsuccessful candidate in this year's mayoral race, also opposes the proposal. She told me she had identified more than 80 underutilized city-owned lots already zoned for residential development where she would rather see housing built. Of course, no project can solve every problem or skirt every concern. Comparison shopping for umbrellas is fine on a sunny day, but when you're caught in a torrential downpour, it's wise to take what's available and run for cover. For their part, proponents of the Park Hill project, in their eagerness to win votes, tended to oversell what it could accomplish. Some described it as a blow against racism or climate change, or a way to help the working class. In my conversations with the plan's backers, I sometimes had to remind myself that we were talking about a 155-acre lot, not the fate of the republic. Land use regulations and development patterns are a key driver of inequality, pollution, and financial strain, but whether or not the Park Hill plan was approved would have a negligible impact on these larger crises, which will require collective action beyond the scope of any one project. Asking a neighborhood or municipality to bear the responsibility for housing crisis and its knock-on effects is asking for failure. Local government simply wasn't built to do this. Just a small fraction of the people even engage in local housing fights. Many of those who do are extreme voices or otherwise unrepresentative of the broader community. Look at Fort Collins, Colorado. After more than 5 years of community engagement and many months of work by city planners, a 5-2 majority on the city council voted to liberalize land use policies to allow more housing. But a small group of opponents pressured the council to reverse itself, gathering 6,500 petition signatures. this in a city of more than 160,000, and they won. The council voted again, this time 7-0, to repeal the change. In interviews, both the head of the Colorado Municipal League, Kevin Baumer, and Denver's current mayor, Michael B. Hancock, touted regional collaboration as a solution to the affordability crisis. But just as one town cannot ensure that the entire region maintains adequate green space while increasing density, it cannot force neighboring towns to work together to find the right balance. The incentive is too strong for an individual government to say to its neighbor, "You can have all the apartments, we'll just keep our parks." The Denver metro area is particularly desperate for small multifamily dwellings, 2 to 9 units, to meet the demand for affordable housing. According to Carrie Macaruas, a professor at the University of Colorado at Denver, roughly 10% of the homes in the region meet this criteria. By contrast, 85% of residentially zoned land is reserved for single-family homes. By this measure, too, the regional associations have come up short. Collective action problems require a body that can hold everyone accountable. Regional associations, which rely on voluntary participation, aren't going to cut it. The democratic process begins by defining the democratic body, and when it comes to housing, the body of concern does not end at a town's boundary line. People moving to the Denver metro area look across the city and into the suburbs for a place to live. One suburb's opposition to building more housing directly affects prices miles away because it constrains the supply in a market that spans municipalities. Local governments, in seeking to satisfy local concerns, undermine statewide goals. At least they do in the absence of state intervention. State government is also about what you can do for me, but on average, that's the electoral reality of representing voters across geographic constituencies. Governors and other statewide officials are forced to see the bigger picture because they're accountable not only to the people who live in a particular community, but also to past residents priced out of and displaced from that community, and to future residents as well. Nor are newcomers overwhelmingly from out of state, as many seem to believe. Census data reveals about 82% of moves happen within states. Denver's council represents the people of Denver, not Aurora, and vice versa. The state represents them all. And in recent polling, 60% of registered voters supported eliminating local restrictions to allow for multifamily housing. I went to the Colorado State Capitol 2 days after the Indivisible Forum to interview Governor Paulus, who told me that housing, transit, travel, roads, these are the interjurisdictional issues because really very few Coloradans live their whole lives in one jurisdiction. Unencumbered by the need to defend any one project or developer, the governor reiterated a simple point. Demand has exceeded supply for the last couple of decades, and prices have gone up. Colorado has to create more housing now. Soon after providing that clean summary of what Colorado needs, Paulus announced his best shot at providing it. Washington, Oregon, California, Utah, Montana, and Massachusetts have, to varying degrees, pulled authority for land use decisions up to the state level. Following their lead, he proposed a bill compelling local governments to adjust their land use policies to meet housing goals, a process that state officials would oversee. The bill addressed climate, infrastructure, and equity concerns, included provisions for increasing and preserving affordable and multifamily housing, encouraged development near transit, and removed onerous parking requirements. Paulus's original proposal was greeted by fierce opposition from local governments, though not because of objections to open space, affordability, or new parking rules. The fight was over where the power to make land use decisions should lie. Kevin Baumer of the Colorado Municipal League offered a pithy synthesis of local government's position. Quote, "Respectfully, get off our lawn," he told me. I asked Baumer about his policy disagreements with the governor, but he kept stressing the issue of local control. My members statewide don't necessarily disagree with a lot of his goals, but to start with saying that the state gets to set a model code and the state gets to regulate and the state will be in charge of the land use going forward is a non-starter. Bomber pointed me to an old amicus brief filed in defense of a local moratorium on fracking by then Representative Paulus. It defended local government's authority over land use decisions as both a state constitution matter and a policy matter. Paulus wrote that local democracy allows for widespread citizen input and broad stakeholder involvement, as well as more opportunities for public participation. The fact that Representative Paulus disagrees with Governor Paulus is exactly the point. A congressman represents his district. He has little reason to care that local control can harm the rest of the state. A governor has a wider remit. If Paulus, the representative, was right, the localities really are the best transmitters of their residents' housing preferences. Then what explains clear, widespread discontent with the outcomes of those decisions? Colorado's housing crisis is undeniable, and its land use authority has rested with local government virtually unquestioned for decades. Colorado's legislative session ended on May 8th. The bill died in the Senate without a final vote. Afterward, the governor told me he intends to keep fighting. States that have passed land use reform, such as California and Washington, suffered multiple defeats before seeing a first victory. Paulus told me he's frustrated by communities that said, "No, we should do it." The thing is, they're not doing it, he said with a laugh. This power struggle is playing out across the country. It's ostensibly a struggle over housing affordability, but it is also a fight over how we see voters. In polls and interviews, voters express deep empathy for people experiencing homelessness and deep frustration with widespread housing unaffordability. But that's not the part of us that local government can hear. Instead, local politics magnifies our selfish concerns. How will this affect my parking availability? What will this do to my view? It doesn't have to be the part that wins. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Have a great day.